Hey everyone, welcome to the Delta Flyers. Robbie and I are super excited to have none other than our good old friend from the show that we all worked on, Ethan Phillips. Ethan, welcome once again.
Ethan.
Hey. Garrett and Robbie, hi. Thank you so much. How you doing?
We're great.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Starting off, right off the bat, we know Long Island, New York is your home, your original home. You grew up there.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And at that time, your father was running a restaurant that his father started, Frankie and Johnny. So can you just tell us a little bit about, you know, just bring us into it when you were a kid. What was it like? Did you go to the restaurant a lot? You know, just give us a little overview.
Have either of you ever been to Long Island?
Yes.
I have. I've spent a bunch of time in Long Island.
Yeah. I didn't know Garrett had been there.
I have,
I grew up there in the 50s and in a middle-class neighborhood.
What part of Long Island exactly?
Nassau County. Uh-huh. So, you know, around there.
After World War II, Nassau County had it sort of exploded. Levittown was out in maybe, was it Nassau or Suffolk?
Levittown was Nassau County.
And, it was.
It just was exploding with people that were working in Manhattan and wanted to live in the suburbs.
Yeah.
My dad commuted to work every day. Every night. He had started there as a bartender. When your grandfather ran the restaurant? Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And when my granddad died, my dad took it over and he had it till the late 80s until he sold it. It had been a speakeasy when it was first founded by my grandfather. And Johnny was my granddad.
Oh.
And Frankie was his partner.
Ah, okay.
And
Okay, so you're Irish American or your Irish, grandfather?
Irish. It breaks down to because I did the DNA thing and I'm mostly Irish. I'm 24.2% Jewish and a certain amount of Scottish. Mostly Irish.
So Johnny was your grandfather. Who was Frankie?
Frankie
was another waiter there. So the guy who had owned it, apparently this is the way my dad, I remember dad told me, he fell down the stairs one night. It was like 1926. And he said, the hell with this place. I'm done with it. My grandfather said, I'll give you $500 for it. And he said, sold. And so he got the waiter to go in with him, Frankie and Johnny. So, and they kept the speakeasy going. If you came to the restaurant, you'd knock and they'd answer and they'd go, Frankie, and you had to say, and Johnny, and then they let you in. And stayed the way it was in 1926 through the entire time. It never changed. 14 tables and a little bar in the back. It was the hangout for the theater people in New York while that
time. Yeah.
Ethan, I don't know if I ever told you this, but I lived for years when I was going to acting school and when I first started in New York, a half a block away from Frankie and Johnny's.
Oh my God.
On 45th between 8th and 9th. I was in the Whitby. Do you remember that building?
Absolutely, because Frankie and Johnny's was 45th between 8th and 7th.
Yeah.
I know that whole block.
You walk by that restaurant, Robbie, thousands of times to go back to your place.
Like a deli downstairs that I would walk because my apartment was 100
Smiley's,
feet from the corner.
Smiley's.
Exactly. I would go to Smiley's. Frankie Johnny's was right upstairs.
Yeah.
And you know what it was before Smiley's? It was Child's.
Child's was a restaurant chain
in the 20s, 30s, and 40s that had places all over the country. And it was kind of like Applebee's today or Denny's. At Child's Restaurant, it was cheap, good, old-fashioned meal. And it was one underneath Frankie and Johnny's for a long time.
Sorry, I'm going down the restaurant road of this neighborhood. Do you remember across the street from Smiley's, JR's, the bar that had the 50-cent burgers or 40-cent burgers?
I remember JR's? Remember Smith's?
That's what I'm thinking of. Sorry. Smith's.
Yeah, they had
Smith's is what I'm thinking of.
They had a great steam table. And you could go in there and get corned beef and cabbage for like $1.50.
Enough. It was pennies. I remember this place, Garrett. I would walk around the corner and actors went there. All the actors went there because it was cheap. Dirt cheap.
Yeah.
And you could get a cheeseburger for like 50 cents or 45 cents.
Remember Barrymore's and Charlie's and all those places?
Charlie's.
Yeah.
It was an actor's heaven. And Frankie and Johnny's, though, was like a step up.
That was the Cadillac.
that was the Cadillac. And I never went to Frankie and Johnny's, but I remember the speakeasy door, because you'd go in this little door on 45th Street, and then these super steep stairs
very steep
took you up to the corner restaurant that was Frankie and Johnny's, and it was tiny. It was a tiny place.
It's a tiny little place. It was a sweet place. It was covered with photos of stars and producers and stuff, and the food was phenomenal.
You said 14 tables, right? That's it. I thought it was much larger. I have a question today. Yes, it's bigger now. Now it's moved to now that it's moved to a different location. Did your father want to take? Was he actively like, yes, I definitely want to take this over, or was he kind of like, maybe someone? Or do you even know this story?
What could he do? It was 1948, 1950. He already had two or three children. I was on the way, and there was another one. What was he going to do? He grew up in the Depression. This is the only real opportunity for him. So he worked his butt off there. He just worked so hard. And I never saw him except on Sundays, which was his day off. I think part of it he liked, part of it he didn't. Mm-hmm. I think he enjoyed being a maitre d'. He was a very friendly man who knew many, many people, had many friends. Mm. And I think part of going to that restaurant each night probably sometimes was like going to host a little party.
Yeah.
And other times I think it was just work. But there was a lot of things to worry about, as anybody who's ever worked in the restaurant business knows.
Yeah.
You have to worry about theft. You have to worry about the health department. You have to worry about the chef being sick. You know, I mean, it was just constantly, or did I order too much meat? We don't have enough tomatoes. Mm. You know, all those worries. I ended up working there in 1978. My dad saw me in a play. Mm-hmm. He wasn't keen on me being an actor, because he knows actors, and he knew how insecure actors can be, because you just never know when your next job is. And he didn't want that life for his son. And, you know, he has five daughters and an actor. That was his attitude at the time. This is not a good smart thing. But then he came to see me in a production of Comedy of Errors at MacArthur Theater with Larry Pine and Angela Pietropinto and Jerry Bammon. And it was a wonderful production. And he came backstage. He said, kid, you got it. You got it, kid. I can see that. He was an astute. He knew acting. So he said, well, you can buy the fruits and vegetables. So he bought me a van, and I used to go up to the South Bronx. South Bronx back in the late 70s was like just a horrible thing. And all the buildings had burnt down. The buildings were all set on fire. And there's many, many pictures. You just Google burning in the South Bronx, and you'll see videos of these vacant buildings, one after another, with big black holes with the windows. Where I remember Mayor Beam, put flowers in the windows. Mm. So you drive across the Cross Bronx Expressway and you look over to the South Bronx and all these buildings had flowers in the windows. They were painted.
Oh God.
They were painted in there so they wouldn't look like what they were, which were ruins. Wow. It was really surreal. I mean, I'd get up at 3:30 in the morning and I'd drive up to the South Bronx, and there was a place up there called Hunts Point, which was the size of about four or five city blocks. It was massive.
Right.
You know, twice the size of the Javits Center. And what it was warehouse after warehouse filled with a specific fruit or vegetable. So there would be a warehouse with nothing but Crenshaw melons.
Okay.
And there'd be a warehouse with nothing but mushroom. And you go into this Crenshaw melon warehouse, and the perfume of the melons would just completely envelop you. Mm. And I would spend like $800-$900 a couple times a week and get tomatoes and potatoes and onions and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And drive back through these absolutely desolate streets. It was horrific. There was this one guy, Goldberg, sold me these mushrooms, this guy Goldberg, and he'd get these big fat mushrooms. And if you didn't call him at 3 a.m. and tell him to save you some, they'd be gone when you got there at 4 a.m. So I used to call him every morning at 2 a.m. I'd set my little alarm. And he'd get on the phone and I said, Goldberg, it's Phillips, save me 7 specials. Done. And he'd hang up. He would meet all kinds of people in there. He met this guy, Ray McCann. This is when I was 16. He was the head of the Marine Engineers Benevolent Association, which was the union representing engineer workers in the Merchant Marine on freighters. So McCann said to him, you know, your kids should go to sea. It'll make a man of them. Yeah. So the next summer, I ship out for 8 months on a freighter.
Seaman. You did this.
Yeah.
You told me about this. You went on the Merchant Marines. I forgot about that.
We sailed around the world. My first port of call was Bremerhaven.
Sorry, Ethan, this is because you met somebody at that 4 a.m. market?
My dad met this guy at the restaurant. All these people come to the restaurant.
Okay.
So he got friendly with this guy, Raymond McKay.
Yeah.
He said, send your kid to sea. You know, so at 16, with my parents' permission, I went out on the SS Potomac.
Oh my God.
In fact, I remember we were at, we were in Zeebrugge, Belgium. And yeah, there were, wow, it was all, there was like 40, there's 45 crew on a big freighter like that.
Yeah, yeah.
There's about 12 officers and the rest are seamen. There was one other college kid whose dad got him a job too on this thing. So he and I became buds, and we were standing on the shore on the port in Zeebrugge and learned that the ship was going to Nam now because they had to pick up some ammunition. The last ship that had gone through there had been blown up. And the crew was a little dicey, but they also knew that they got double pay. And so it was kind of very, but we thought we're not going to Nam. We were going to jump ship until we found out it was a felony. So we stayed on, and then we never went to Vietnam. We went to South Carolina. So it was, but for a couple of days, we're going to Vietnam. It was scary, you know?
Wow.
But he would meet these people. He met this guy who ran the Great Northern Paper Company.
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, we have this job, but your son would benefit from it. So what was that? It's a river driver. So what they would do up in Maine, in Northern Maine, they would cut down the trees in the winter. And mm-hmm. pull them into logs, and they put them out on the lake in Millinocket, and they float down to the dam in Millinocket and be made into paper.
Yeah.
But about 20% got caught up into the swamp grass and the rocks and everything, the shore of this huge lake, Chesuncook. And they sent out these picking crews to pull the logs out of the rocks and the driftwood and everything, wow, and pull them out into the lake. And then they'd boom them up and bring them down. So I did that for 2 summers.
This is all high school? This is all during... School,
yeah.
This, yeah. So this is before you were a buyer of the food and the mushrooms.
This is back in the late,
way before.
This is the late 60s.
Like after school, in grade school, you didn't go to the restaurant and hang out after, and none of that stuff. You said you didn't see your dad until Sunday. That's it.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I know you told me one time that you would sometimes go to see a play or something in town and then bring a friend over for dinner.
Yeah, occasionally, but we saw a lot of theater as children. I'd invite a young lady to come with me, and my dad said, "Well, bring her over for dinner."
Right.
So I'd take her to Frankie and Johnny's and share a meal with her, and then go to the play.
Right.
But I it wasn't my world. It was his business, and I don't think he wanted us there a lot.
But he wanted you to take it over, though. I mean, that was his hope until he saw you in that play, and he says, "You got it, kid," and he knew. He didn't.
He wanted me to be like a doctor or a lawyer. I mean, people don't become actors. You know, that who becomes an actor? It's ridiculous.
Right.
And he just thought, you know, your chances are just really, really low that you'll make a living out of it. And he was right.
He's right. The chances are very low for and anyone to become.
The three of us were in the right place at the right time.
Yeah. God knows,
there's just as many people who are talented as us who could have done those jobs we did.
Yes.
But we had done the right sequence of things that ended us up in that place where we were seen for that role.
That's exactly
and,
right.
And so it's, I always tell people it's tenacity, it's talent, but it's luck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's just luck. I have so many friends who are just extraordinarily talented.
Yeah. I think someone said luck is when timing meets with preparation. Like you have to be ready for it when it happens or else you'll miss that.
Preparation meets opportunity.
That's what it is. Preparation meets opportunity.
The waves didn't break for them like they did for others, and that's just the way it is.
Yeah, it's very interesting, Ethan. I just want to ask, so your father, where did he grow up? Because you grew up in like Nassau County, Levittown, Long Island suburbs, which was brand new suburbs. That whole experience was just evolving, the idea of suburbs and living out of Long Island. Before that, where did your father grow up?
Well, my dad was born in Philly, in South Philly. He actually took me there once to see his house. It was a, you know, real poor neighborhood. His mom died during the Spanish flu in 1918.
Wow.
So he didn't have a mom, and his dad was, I don't think, you know, a very present father in his life. And he grew up, I think, with aunts, and he was very circumspect. He rarely talked about, my mom didn't either, rarely talked about their early lives. And so I know that he spent time in orphanages and living with aunts and stuff. And you know,
wouldn't that be interesting if your dad met Picardo's dad, who also was in Philly at the time, and Picardo's mom, right? That would
be
interesting
if
they crossed each other's paths.
I think he came from a more middle class background, Bob did.
Okay.
I'm almost positive. I don't know for a fact. My grandfather, when he was 18, went to fight in World War I.
Oh my God.
While he was there, his wife died.
He was on the tour and he came home and the wife had passed away.
She died during the flu.
The war was going on. The Spanish food.
He was gassed in Ypres, Y-P-R-E-S, Ypres, I think it's called. Mm-hmm. He came back.
Mustard gas.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And he came back, and what is, here it is, it's 1920. He's a young man. He has the balls to get up and go to New York and make his way in the world. Wow. And so he was quite a determined fella. And my dad grew up under tough circumstances. I think he wanted that as a fallback in case I didn't. I studied English literature, and I was into things that had nothing to do with business. I had no business mind. I've never had a
business mind. What point did you get that acting? When did the acting bug bite you? I know that you've done other things such as play instruments as well. So what point in your life did you feel that I gotta get into this?
When I was a kid and I'd watch TV and I'd get scared because something was gonna happen. Mm. I remember my mom telling me this episode of Panic. So I think CBS, it was an anthology series back in the 50s, and it was a very scary episode. And I started freaking out. I was like seven. My mom saying, "No, honey, no, you don't have to worry about them. They're just pretending." What do you mean? They're pretending. They're being photographed for us. They're going to have a coffee break soon and then do that exact same scene again. And I went, "What? These are adults and they're doing this? Yes, this is how they make their living." And I went, "Ooh. That's pretty cool. I kind of lodged it in the back of my head, like we'd play what we used to call cowboys. And if I got shot in the game, if somebody shot me, I was done with the game. I would lay on the sidewalk for an hour and a half dead because I was going to pretend that I really got shot. I was committed, completely committed
to the game.
So that, I just loved pretending in these bizarre situations, because my own situation was just kind of really, domestic, middle-class Long Island in the 50s. Now I could be a cowboy on a horse and get shot and die and be dead. And then at the end, come back to life and go home and have dinner.
When did you start playing saxophone? I want to get into your musical ability.
In high school, just going back to that time, though, that early time when I was working at the restaurant, that whole time in the mid to late 70s when I was in New York, I'd come down from grad school and, what it was like, Robbie, because you were there too. You weren't there.
I came to New York in 1982, summer, August of 1982. So New York was just beginning to start to recover.
Yeah. Cause we were,
because in the 70s, when I visited New York,
it's crazy.
It was very frightening. Yeah. Some of the places, as you came into the city through Fort Washington or Washington Heights,
it was
a scary place.
New York, it was the summer of Sam. It was, there were blackouts. I was living with three people in a two room apartment on 24th and 10th. I was trying to be an actor. I was waiting tables. I was working at a mental institution at night. I was cleaning toilets at this bar in 24th and 10th. I was going to auditions. I was doing plays on like Avenue D. Everybody was taking classes. And I thought, no, the thing is to keep doing plays. Mm-hmm. You learn more on stage in one night than you do in 50 classes. So I would do all these little plays and
were a million of them because everybody was fleeing New York. Garrett, I know you're a young man. You're a young man. You may not remember this.
Well,
I was a young man when I came to New York. I was 17 when I came to New York City.
Right. You were a boy.
But my first apartment was on 129th and Riverside. It was in Spanish Harlem. And I would take the Broadway local, the one train, up to my stop and then walk from Broadway down to Riverside past what you describe. And three out of four buildings were burned out. I would walk past all of these boarded up, there was metal. They would cover the windows in metal. And it was all graffitied. The subway cars.
I went to high school in Crown Heights, which today you can't get an apartment for less than $1 million. Back then you couldn't find the subway. Nobody had ever made it.
It was a different city back then.
It was a totally different city. But there was a community.
I came into the end of that.
You came at the very end. In 82, what happened in 80, the stock market started to go up and things changed. Like when I was there, Times Square was It looked like red light section of Hamburg. Oh, yeah. I mean, it was porn shops, bars, and hookers, and junkies. And that was 42nd Street. And nobody went there. I used to go there all the time because you could see a double bill.
Yeah, you wouldn't walk between Broadway and 8th Avenue on 42nd without, you know, being in a group of people. It was very dangerous.
Yeah, it was very. You wouldn't go into Central Park. I've got my first apartment in 1978. I finally got my own little apartment. It was a one room apartment on 83rd and Amsterdam.
Okay.
And it had a bathroom in the hall. I shared it with, there were three apartments and we all shared the same bathroom.
Oh, God.
It was $190 a month. Oh. But it was my own place.
Yeah.
The only problem with it, there were more cockroaches there than you could even imagine. And I used to get my dad's exterminator. This is a guy who exterminates a restaurant to come in and exterminate. It still wouldn't kill the roaches. I'd leave and they'd say, bring back chocolate or we'll change the locks. These are the kind of cocky cockroaches they were. They were arrogant. They were
very arrogant.
So you got there at 82, Robbie, okay? So yes. I was a freshman at UCLA at 85. In 88, I got an American Express card. American Express card gave every person that had a student American Express card, they gave two vouchers. These vouchers were on Continental Airlines. It was a round-trip ticket anywhere in the U.S. for $49 round-trip.
Oh, my God.
That's what it was. So you get two of them. So I said, I'm going to get the most I can out of it. I'm going to go as far as I can, which will be New York City. So that was the first time I went. It was 1988.
Wow.
So this is 6 years after you got there. But I got there and I fell in love with it. So I was like,
I was there. We were there.
Yes, you both of you were there.
Both of you were there.
I kind of walked past. I probably walked past you guys. I did. I'm just saying it happened. But I loved it. And I used every voucher every year. I'd get two more vouchers. So I went to New York as a college student twice a year, flying for $49.
That's great, man. That's great.
Amazing. So good.
You know, New York is after New York, I always say everything else is camping out. I would never live anywhere else.
Yeah.
I just is my favorite place in the world. I'm never going to leave it.
Yeah.
And every time you leave your apartment, there's something going on. It's always exciting.
Can we rewind a little bit to your bachelor's degree in English literature at BU? Mm-hmm. How did that happen? Why did you go to BU?
I went to Catholic schools my whole life. High school was all boys. Mm-hmm. And then I went to a Jesuit. It was a Jesuit prep school. And then I went to a Jesuit college. Again, it was all boys. And I went to visit my buddy. He was up at Boston University. He's one of my oldest friends. And I couldn't believe that there were all these beautiful women everywhere. And I thought, I want to go here. I'm going to this university. And so I transferred to BU.
So you were at the Jesuit University for one semester?
Two semesters. And then
And then you were gone. You were like,
I wanted to go where there were women.
Well, that makes sense. It makes
sense.
Is
that all right?
Yeah.
That's how I ended up there. And then my subject was Latin. And so I had this vague idea that I might be a Latin teacher. Because I was really good at it.
I could see you doing that.
It was just a chance to really get away from just that kind of insulated environment that I had been in for so long. Open a window and it was a beautiful place.
You know, going to Boston University must have been like...
Boston in the late 60s, early 70s, dude.
Yeah,
I mean, it was Scars and Simon and Garfunkel and English poetry and let's go listen to Bob Dylan. And it was just this whole romantic kind of, you know, thing. And it was just great to be part of that. And it was a very political time, very political. And it opened my eyes to a lot of things. And I really enjoyed it. And I got into acting while I was there in a serious way. I was in a class where a guy named Vinnie Murphy came in, who to this day is one of my oldest friends. And he said, we're doing Taming of the Shrew. If anybody wants to audition, come in to blah, 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 blah. So my girlfriend, Sally Bowden, said to me, well, didn't you act in high school? I said, yeah. She says, you should audition. So I said, yeah, maybe I will. So I went in and I auditioned for Grumio, who was Petruchio's sidekick in Taming of the Shrew. And I got the part. I really had fun. You know, and all of a sudden I met all these other people that were really into acting, and it was really a good production. I just knew that this was fun and that I really enjoyed this. And it's like we talked about this once with Chariots of Fire, where the guy says, God made me fast, and when I run, I feel him smile. And that God made me able to pretend really well. And when I do it, I hear him smile. You know, kind of silly like that, but I felt that this is my thing. And I started looking around and I said, I think I can do this. I'm pretty sure. And if I don't try, I'll regret it my whole life.
Yeah.
And I turned out to be cast a lot.
Yeah.
You know, I was a short guy and I wasn't bald back then. You know, I was a character type. So that was real. That helped me back then, you know.
Were you sporting the long hair then?
In college, I had hair down to here.
Oh,
but everybody did back then.
Right. Everyone had long hair then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was to show you. So you're under 30, you know.
Got it.
What did your parents think about your long hair?
They were adverse to it.
They were adverse to it. Oh, yeah. Ethan, one other thing that I forgot to bring up is when we were working on the show together, we talked a little bit about how you loved football. And this is something that Robbie and I, we both love football, but we don't typically talk a lot about football because a lot of our listeners don't really follow football. But this is probably middle school and junior high. Is that right? That you're, yeah.
Sixth, seventh, and eighth grade. Yes. I was a right guard and I was a monster.
Right. And also you played on defense. You were at defensive end. Is that right?
No, I just played right guard.
Offensive guard only. Yeah. Okay. And you mauled people.
I ran them over. I just got rid of a lot of aggression, I guess, or a lot of stress. And so just charge into somebody.
Yeah.
But then when I had high school, people got much bigger than me. Gotcha. You know, there were guys there who were, you know, 6'2 and weighed 250 pounds. I couldn't compete. So that's why I went into the drama club and started working there.
Yeah. But when you did compete, you loved it. This was something you absolutely adored. But do you still follow it at all? Do you watch it?
Once I couldn't play anymore, I stopped following it. I'm a baseball fan today.
Yeah.
I love baseball. I follow the Mets, even though it's pretty sad.
It is sad for the Mets right now. Yes.
Oh God almighty. How'd they do that? They played the Twins last night. I didn't even want to look at the score. I didn't know what it was.
Do you have a secondary team other than the Mets that you cheer for? Or is it just the Mets?
Well, not really, no.
Okay.
I joke around. I'll say to my friends, hey, how about those Padres the other night? No, I don't follow any of them. It's just the Mets. But I like referencing the others.
Ethan, you remember when we were filming the show when Robbie was just absolutely gaga over Atlanta at the time? I mean, Atlanta was, didn't they win the
Braves?
I'm sorry, they were, yeah.
The Braves
didn't
won.
The Braves in the 90s, when we made the show together,
they were like the Yankees.
They were the dominant team of the
90s. They were a big deal.
Yeah.
But yet they couldn't seem to win a World Series. They won one World Series in that decade.
Oh, that's what it was.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. They only won. They only got one. But they would have the best seasons all year. They would be dominant.
Yeah. Yeah. I was into baseball than when we were doing that.
If you remember this, Ethan, Robbie would, some of the crew guys would have the game on it in their little TVs there, and Robbie would go over and watch it and see what was happening and then go back on the set and act a little bit. So he was so invested in the Atlanta
Braves. I remember you doing that, Robbie,
I was very invested in the Braves in the 90s. I was. Yeah. I've kind of moved my passions to the Georgia Bulldogs college football team.
Yeah.
Which I've been a big college football fan for the last 15, 20 years. Oh, I was always a fan, but my dominant passions have shifted from baseball to college football.
And to college football.
Two years ago, Ethan, when they were in the championship, I secretly bought a ticket and flew to Utah, rented a car, and drove to McNeil's house.
He did.
He surprised the game
me.
With him to surprise him.
I was going to the post office. I pulled down the driveway. Yeah. And I'm like, who's that creep driving back and forth in front of my house? Who's that creepy guy?
I didn't know what his house looked like. I was lost and came out.
And he came out and found him. That is funny. Yeah. Good
and
for
he was
you,
like,
Garrett.
What are you doing here? I was like, I heard there's a game on. And so I came to help support and they won.
He's
so I
totally
feel like
surprised
they,
me.
I think they won because I showed up in Utah.
I think that's why they did. I read that.
I think I made Garrett go to the recycling center. It was not the post office. It was recycling. I was going to the recycling center. I was like, well, I'm on my way to the recycling center. Come on, get in the car.
Oh, God.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You know, the thing is, I could talk about any sport in the world as if I'm completely knowledgeable. Because I just go, like I'd say to somebody, go, man, what happened last night to the Rockies? And I'll go, you tell me. I couldn't believe it. And then they'd go, well, when he struck out, and I'd go, there was no reason. And I'll just say nothing. And they'll go, yeah, but McKellen, he comes on to first. He says he shouldn't even been on first. He said, why not? And I go, well, what do you think? I mean, and then he go, well, he did drop the thigh. He dropped it. It fell right out of his mitt. The guy didn't even try. So now these think people think I saw
the damn game. Yeah.
And I can do the same with football.
Oh, God.
I know these people on the street that think I'm a massive football fan. They'll come in and go, the Chiefs are going to have a great year. And I said, maybe. Have you looked what's on the bill? Have you seen the offense on the Bills this year? Have you seen their offense? You tell me they're not going to make mincemeat of the Chiefs. God bless them. And then he'd get in. Then they give a monologue because they love to talk about it. They a monologue on the Chiefs and the Bills. And I'd nod and interject. And so I don't know who the hell the Bills are. I don't know where they're from. I don't even know. Are they lacrosse? Are they hockey? Well, I wouldn't
they're
even
football
know.
And they're Buffalo.
Well, oh, there you go. I didn't even know that.
I love it. I love it.
So oh, you've been a God. Pretender your whole life.
I've always pretended.
Did this come out of your acting or was this before your acting?
Oh, God. He just put the pin on.
He put on the random flight pin.
My random flight pin.
Robbie's bamboo pin is on.
I used to love pretending.
Yeah.
I mean,
did you do it as a kid? Like before acting?
I'll tell you what happened. I would fall down two flights of stairs and lie there comatose. And people would run down and go, what's wrong? And I woke up, just kidding. And I do this. I always did this. It backfired on me really badly in 1964.
Uh-oh.
I got into skateboarding. Uh-huh. I've always been into that stuff, like rock climbing and paragliding and all that. I just love doing that stuff.
You skateboarded.
We used to build our own. We'd get a piece of wood and we'd screw roller skate wheels on.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
And that's and how it started. Just were nuts. And I was obsessed with it. And one night I was in front of Jay Mettler's house. He lived two doors down from me. And I was with my friend Chuck LaBella, Jay Mettler, Mead Brown. I was hanging 10 and I went over a curb and I fell off the curb and I split my leg in half.
Oh.
My whole shin just broke in half and the bottom bone on my foot popped out.
Oh, God.
And oh, I lay there screaming in pain.
And they didn't believe you.
No, they're laughing their asses off. Phillips, this is amazing. And I'm going, I'm not kidding, guys. I really. And finally, it was a little girl lived in the neighborhood, Kathy Coyle. I remember her. Kathy Coyle.
She's like, his bone is sticking out.
He's sticking out of his foot.
But I had long pants. You couldn't see it. I said, Kathy, they won't believe me. Please get my mom. And they got my mom. And my mom leave me right away. And they called the ambulance. And as I was being gurneyed into the ambulance, Chuck LaBella says, Phillips, I don't believe you'd go this far. This is awesome.
They thought you were still kidding. Pretending. Oh, yeah. My God.
So that's how it backfired on me.
You're the ultimate boy who cried wolf, aren't you?
You were a born actor.
I'm a born
how
actor.
How old were you when your leg broke like that?
14.
How old was this? 14. You were a teenager. Wow. Yeah, that must have been excruciating to have your...
Have you ever broken a bone?
Yeah. So bad. Yeah.
It's the worst pain in the world.
It's really bad, but not like your... It didn't come out... I broke my wrist playing soccer, actually, but I never had a bone sticking out. So it was coming out of your foot, right?
It peeked out of the shin. And they said it, but I was in the hospital for a couple of weeks because it was a bad break.
What'd your mom say when
that's
she saw you?
Compound
my mom
fracture.
Started crying.
Oh, God. Of course. This is her baby with a broken, a bone coming out. Course. She's going to cry. My God.
But it's all healed up.
But your friends, your quote friends, they didn't believe it.
Like, you were Phillips, you're the
you were
funniest.
Such an actor.
Yeah. I don't believe. I'm just LaBella saying I don't believe you'd go this far, Phillips.
That's amazing.
And I'm still friends with Chuck to this day. He went on to become
awesome.
Yeah, what did Chuck do?
Chuck was assistant. DA in San Diego. He was once on the list to be head of FBI. He went on to become a major prosecuting attorney.
Wow.
Nice. But we're still close. He's a great guy. Yeah. And I'm still close with Mead. Mead became a labor lawyer. He lives in Washington.
What about lovely Miss Coyle? Young Miss Coyle. What is she doing?
I have no idea what happened to Kathy Coyle, you know? I was friends with her brother, older brother, Tommy Coyle. Yeah. He was a friend of mine. That's just when I was in my teens. I don't know what happened to Tommy either.
Because it sounds like if Coyle didn't come out, lovely Kathy Coyle, you'd still be in that street with a broken bone.
I might still be there with a broken bone.
I think so.
50 years later.
Yeah, 50 years later. It's like, get my mom, somebody.
I never got on another skateboard again.
Oh, my God. Were you trying a jump? What were you doing when you broke it? I'm just trying to.
I was hanging 10, so I had.
Yeah. Oh, all both my your, toes. Yeah. The, sorry. At the front of the board, correct?
The board,
okay. Gosh. And then you hit the. What you hit?
I went over the curb.
Yep.
And I don't know what happened, whether a wheel or something, but I flipped over and I landed the wrong way and my shin just split in two.
It sounds like you somersaulted midair and landed on your shin the wrong way and it just snapped. You did a Joe Theismann basically, right? Where everyone
God. Yeah. And then LaBella Chuck brought me a strawberry shake when I was in the hospital and he ended up drinking the whole thing. I'll never forget that.
Good old Chucky.
All right. All right. So we've established you're a great bullshitter and a great actor. And, you know, when you're not actually performing a script, you can fake people out. Yeah. But let's talk about your creative process as an actor. Now that you're a professional card carrying actor, you're licensed to do this for a professional.
I'm licensed to do this.
You're licensed to be a professional. Yeah.
Don't try this at home.
You're licensed to do it professionally. What is your creative process when you first get a script or a role or a scene?
It's evolved. Yeah. I remember when I was in high school doing things like Charlie's Aunt and, you know, The Little Prince and the kind of plays you did in high school.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think I just wanted to make people laugh. Mm-hmm. So, and I was good at telling jokes. So I would, you know, try to find the right way to say it, you know, but I didn't really understand what it was. I told you the story where I auditioned for the first time for a play at high school and the priest had me read this line from Macbeth and which I'll say because we're not in a theater. Right. And the character has like only one line or very little in the fifth scene, and the man comes up to him and he says, "My lord, your son has been cut in half and lays slain on the battlefield." And my line is, "He is dead then." And which is a very funny line if you want to play it that way.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a big laugh there.
A huge laugh. So I said, "He's dead then." And the priest went, "Come on, kid. This man's son is dead. He died in battle. He's feeling pride, but he's feeling sadness. There's so much he's feeling. I can't even, you got to convey some of that." And I was 14 and I remember thinking, oh, I just have to pretend that something bad happened to me.
Yeah.
So what would happen if my cat Beanie died?
Yeah. Oh,
I would be so sad.
Yeah.
And so I kind of translated that feeling into "he is dead then."
Yeah.
And so you just taught yourself that substitution. You just
substitution. Yeah. Didn't you know.
Did substitution.
Mm-hmm. And he stepped back and he said, "You're good, kid."
Mm.
And that felt really good.
Yeah.
To know that I was good at something.
Yeah.
And to get a pat on the back, which was wonderful.
Right.
And then they started putting me in bigger roles and pretty soon I was getting the lead and everything. And that's all I did was try to pretend like it was really happening, but I didn't have any technique or anything. And then I met real actors when I started working in Boston after I got out of college, Tim McDonough and Vinnie Murphy and a lot of these people, Karen Ross, they had studied it and they had a technique. There's a story about Laurence Olivier where he says, you know, one night he came off and he was so good and everybody said, "You were so good." He said, "I know the gods are with me." And he said, "But on nights they aren't, it's technique." And so I didn't really have any technique, but I learned a little technique in grad school where we would break down the script into verbs.
Mm-hmm.
So what am I trying to do here? Well, am I trying to seduce them?
Mm-hmm.
Am I trying to praise them? Am I trying to get something from them? So you had a specific action to play. So now I had an action to play. Then what tactic was I going to use with that action? Was I going to do it in a friendly way? Or was I going to do it in a sinister way? You know, and I'd had to literally think this stuff through. So I'd go through the script with a pen and go, "I am assaulting. I am backing off. I am," and so I could orient myself.
Yeah.
And I gradually realized in rehearsal, as I rehearsed a play, I would find moments. It's like when you do a rock climb, there's always one pitch that's the crux. And that's where the difficulty of the climb is apparent. And in a play is always about the most important day in the lives of these people who you're playing. That's the most important day in their lives. Yeah. Otherwise, it's not worth doing it. And it would always be a most important moment. Mm-hmm. And I would find that moment through the help of the director and the other actors. And I'd practice that moment. And I'd try to make it believable. as it would be to me. I used to even do this image technique where I'd go, what if I was trying to get out of East Germany and I was being spied on by the East Germans and I had to convince them that this was what I was saying was true so they would let me leave East. I'd do these games in my head. So I would repeat, I'd do it until it was real. Mm-hmm. And then I would, then that was a bolt I could put down on the stage. Okay, now I know I'm safe with that moment.
Yeah.
And I would put bolts down throughout the play and I'd have 6 or 7 bolts where I knew where I was going, I was safe. Then was all the interstitials, what can I throw away?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what can I do? And then gradually all this stuff goes by the wayside and you don't even think about it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time you're trying to piece together a way to approach a role. William H. Macy, he said something wonderful once. He said, you know, I go to the set and I sit around all day. And then they want me for 5 minutes and I have to do something magical, sexy, mysterious, funny, real, powerful. And until I do that, they don't get to go home. You're aware of that. You're acting something that has, there's stakes. There's stakes.
Yeah.
There's always stakes, you know. I just kind of waddled through it. I don't know what the hell I did. Mm. I just knew that sometimes I hit it. And when I did, I tried to remember what it was that made me hit it. But I didn't reflect on it too much. I just kept doing plays. I just kept doing plays and plays, and I did plays and plays. And I gradually learned how to edit myself up there. And I gradually learned how to do a close-up on stage. And I gradually learned how to give and receive because it's a game. You know, I toss the ball to you.
Yeah.
I'm going to do you. I don't care about me. I'm going to do you. And they'll come back to me. I'm going to do you. And we're giving each other this back and forth. And I would find my performance in the other actor's eyes if he was there. Jennifer Lean used to give me that. Jennifer Lean was so raw and without skin when she acted, I had scenes with her. And I could find everything I needed just by looking at Jennifer.
Wow.
She would give me everything I needed. And I find that to be true. Pretty much so. I mean, there are sometimes you'll work with a person who is a little untutored and still doesn't know it. But by then you have technique and you can get through stuff you have to do. But if you're working with the good one, you don't need, you can do, I've done plays that have run a year and the last performance is just as new as the first one. Because I'm working with people who are making it fresh every night and they know it's the illusion of the first time. They know these people have never seen it. And I love owning it and I love going on with it. And I've worked with actors who said, how can you do that? Who've never done, I did a movie with Joaquin Phoenix, a brilliant film actor, never done a play. He said, how do you do that? I'd go out of my mind by the third night because he hadn't experienced it. But I wonder what he would feel like if he actually did a play and realized that when the language is that brilliant, when you're doing Molière or Shakespeare or something, and I mean, I don't want to sound pompous. I'm not, but there really is something incredible about these amazing playwrights.
The thing that I guess I will give an opinion or a judgment about you, Ethan, is that you really value the process in a way that not every actor does. I've always known this about you, that you love the process of acting.
It's so much fun.
The experience of just the magic that happens in the moment and whether or not it's received with, you know, accolades, whether it's a hit, whether I know about you that that's not the priority, that the priority is I want to have an experience, a human experience that's real, that's authentic, that has depth and value. And
I want the story to be told. I want the writer to experience what was in his head. It may not be what he thought when he wrote that line, but I want to give him something that he'll be equally satisfied with. That's very important. I want to please the writer also.
It sounds like a lot of in terms of your process was learned on the job.
It was doing on plays. The job.
Yes. You had conservative when you got your MFA at Cornell. Yeah. You had training, scene study classes, whatever, stage combat movement. But outside of that, after you got your MFA, you really didn't study with any teachers outside. You just started doing plays. Is that correct?
Yeah, I just started doing it. And the thing that I experienced most at Cornell was not the acting classes.
Mm-hmm.
It was the fact that we were hired to do summer stock. So each summer I would do 4 or 5 plays in rep.
Yep.
And throughout the year, we were always hired. We were always doing plays for the Cornell student body.
Right.
So I was doing classics. I was doing, you know, Shakespeare and Molière. I was doing all the great ones. We were doing Pirandello. I mean, I was in all things I would never be cast at, playing roles that I would never be cast in. And I got to experience them. And yeah, so I learned doing it. And it was fun. It was never work.
What year did you write your first, that one play that you wrote? Or is there more than one play? Was it 19?
Several plays. That was 87.
87 was the first one, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that was a dare. I'd been going to
Sundance.
Yeah, oh, I would go to Sundance, and they have a film program there in the summer, and they had a theater program, and they would invite young playwrights. I mean, I did the very first reading, or certainly one of the first readings of Angels in America in 19, I don't know what it was. Up in Tony Kushner came there with this play that he was writing, and we were there to support the writers. So I was really indoctrinated into this. You're a craftsperson, and your job is to make sure the writers get the idea that he's trying to get at. The goal is sent to the audience.
Right.
They have to receive that.
Yeah.
You can't mumble it. You got to send that idea. And so I really wanted to make sure that the audience got it, but I didn't want to be over the top. And I have a tendency to go over the top. I'd rather go over the top than do nothing. One of my favorite actors is Jack Nicholson, because he doesn't care.
he doesn't.
He does not.
True. How was it a dare that you wrote the play? Well, how did that happen?
So the gentleman who was the artistic director of the St. Anne's Theater group, he said, I've been there a couple of times, he says, I dare you to write a one act. I said, all right. So I went around and I thought for a long time, and I won't go into how I came up with the idea, but I came up with a pretty good idea, and I told it to a friend of mine who was a dramaturg, taught dramaturgy at UCLA, and he said, that's a terrific idea, but there's no conflict. Why don't you try blah, blah, blah? And I went, oh, God, you're right. That would really, and I went home and I rewrote the whole thing in one big rush.
Wow.
And it got best one act of the year. And
that's awesome.
It was published.
Wow. That is so
cool.
But
I never wanted to be a writer. It was really just a dare. And then I wrote another full length that's pretty good too. But I'm not interested in writing or lighting or directing. Or I wanted to just be the guy on the stage.
Yeah. Passing the message on to the audience of the writer.
That's who I want to be. Okay. I remember when Robbie left to direct, I remember thinking, Pete, you're an actor. What the hell are you doing?
What are you doing,
And then I said, well, now you'll be able to put yourself in all your shows. And then Robbie would never do that. I go, why are you hiring me? Do it yourself. You get to act. My friend Robert Schenken, who has won a Pulitzer and a Tony and became one of the great writers who were at Cornell together. I did 50 plays with Robert at Cornell, and he was a brilliant actor, and he left it to become a writer. And I couldn't, Robert, why are you leaving to become a writer? Because he loved writing and he was really good at it. But to me, it doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. You know,
you loved acting.
Well, it's funny because not only Robbie, but Roxanne too. Both of them, right after our show ended, they just left the world of acting.
Has she acted at all?
Oh, I don't think so. Right, Robbie? So. And she could have put herself in her own projects, I'm sure, but she didn't.
Absolutely.
Do it. Yeah. And Robbie, you talked about that on that funny show, Spy Show, you did. You talked about like, oh yeah, I might be in on that one episode or whatever as a SWAT guy or whatever, but then you didn't do it. You kept backing out.
Yeah. I always backed out.
What was it about it that you decided this is not for me?
I did ultimately in that comedy spy show. Yeah. I did do a very small one or two line role.
Oh, you did? Oh,
yes.
I didn't know that.
Okay.
And I was stuck in a helicopter with another actor while we were lighting and getting ready to shoot. And I had asked the line producer, I said, hey, why don't you direct this scene since I'm going to be stuck here. I can't really, this is not a situation where I can direct and act.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't you just, because I'm stuck in the helicopter that's all, you know, tied into the logistics. So I just said to Paul, I said, you direct this if you can. And I was stuck in the helicopter. And I remember thinking, as I'm listening to the actors talking to each other, and I was like, I would rather be out there talking to the camera operator about the angle and the lens size and is the lighting right? And I'd rather be out there because this is like the killing time in between acting was not interesting to me. I didn't find that. Like, I'm with you. Like those moments when you're you're riding the wave, you're in the scene, that experience. But in the world of film and television, those moments are so rare. Mm-hmm. And like Bill Macy said, you know, for 9 hours or 12 hours, the actors are mostly sitting around.
Yeah.
And right. if I'm going to spend 9 or 12 hours on a set or whatever, 14 hours on a set, I always enjoyed feeling vital to the conversations.
How did the saxophone begin for you?
You guys don't remember the Dave Clark Five. They were the band that came right out after the Beatles. The Beatles in 1964 played I Want to Hold Your Hand, and it was a big deal, and they came to America. And the band that immediately followed them was not the Rolling Stones. It wasn't The Who. It wasn't Pink Floyd. It was the Dave Clark Five from Tottenham. Mm-hmm. And it was a group of five men. Dave Clark was the drummer, and they had a saxophone player, Denny Payton, and they had a bunch of hits, In Pieces, Bits, and Glad All Over, and all these wonderful kind of pop tunes, and they became a big deal. So the saxophone player, and I thought, God, that's the coolest looking instrument I've ever seen in my life. It's so sexy, so awesome. I want to play that. So my dad got me a really cheap one for like $150, and I started taking lessons, and I learned how to read music, and eventually got into music theory, and I just started taking lessons every day. And I had a lesson this morning. I spent my morning trying to figure out how to get from B minor 7 to D half diminished to A diminished, arpeggiating them, because see, on a saxophone you can't play a chord.
Yeah.
So if you're going to play the C chord, you have to play C, E, G, and B. So, you know, from the little you play in the clarinet. So we must spend an hour and a half just doing these three chords and so many different inversions. And then we were able to plug it into Bye Bye Blackbird. So when I got to those chords in Bye Bye Blackbird, I was able to plug in these new riffs,
new transition.
And it was so much fun. And I just love doing that. But when it comes to playing in groups, I only play rock band. I will only be in a rock band because as much as I love jazz, it's too hard for me to do what the pros do. They've been playing 10,000 hours.
That group that inspired you, Dave Clark Five. Yeah, Dave I think Clark you Five. Said they're from Tottenham. Is that what you Tottenham. Said?
Yeah. They
oh, were. You know who's from Tottenham that we all know?
Who?
Marina Sirtis.
Oh, she's from Tottenham.
That's her neighborhood. Yeah. Oh, she cheers for the Tottenham Hotspurs. She loves Hotspurs, that football. Yes. And that's her old stomping grounds is Tottenham, which is where the Dave Clark Five are from. That's who inspired you to go into your musical career. Wow. That's insane.
But now I listen to Sonny Stitt, and I listen to Coltrane, and I listen to Ben Webster, and I listen to Michael Brecker, and I listen to Buddy Tate, and I listen to Gene Ammons, and I listen to all these guys. And I just have so many people I listen to, and I just love them. And they floor me. They floor me at the level of craft they had.
That's so cool. Yeah.
Anything else about the creative process?
You know, I've written a lot about acting just for myself. Like it's a Christopher Walken quote. The truth is good, but interesting is better. You know, Ellen Burstyn explains that her preparation for any role involves taking an elevator down to my inner archive, where I quietly flip through the files until some memory rises up and offers itself. You know, and that's what we were talking about before.
Yeah.
You know, this is a quote from Alan Ruck. Do you know Alan Ruck?
Yeah.
We did a couple of movies together. He's a great guy. And he said to me once, he said, somebody asked me once, how do I choose my roles? And I was like, Meryl Streep and Brad Pitt do that. That's not how it is for the rest of us. And that's true. We don't choose our roles.
This is Alan
comes
Sanders.
To me, I'll take it. Yeah.
Yeah, I love Alan. He's
a great guy. As you get older, you want to get back to that transcendent thing, that point where you're no longer thinking, I'm going to hit my mark now, and then she's going to say her line. You're just existing. See how close to the edge you can get. This is a very famous Mike Nichols quote. That was wonderful. Now do it as yourself. I just think that's
Mike
brilliant.
Nichols. Oh, my God.
Yeah,
he was directing a movie when we were filming in the first season. He was directing something on the set.
Was
something
he?
On the lot. Yeah. Wasn't that what Robin Williams, when he came over to visit our set, isn't that Mike Nichols? I could have sworn that's what it was.
Yeah, but it was Lakasha Fall. That's when I ran into him in the alley. We had a great moment together. Remember Brimley? What was his name?
Wilford Brimley. Yes.
This is something I wrote down. Robert Duvall recalled a set to, I guess, a kind of an altercation between Mr. Brimley and the director, Bruce Beresford, who had made a suggestion about how Mr. Brimley might play the role of Harry. And Brimley goes, now, look, let me tell you something. I'm Harry. Harry's not over there. Harry's not over here. Until you fire me or get another actor, I'm Harry, and whatever I do is fine because I'm Harry.
That's great.
This is Chris Plummer. Don't study your lines. Read the play. Read the play. Read the play over and over and over again. You learn the play. And that's what I memorized the whole play when I'm in a play.
Yeah, you've said that before.
I memorized the whole play.
So everybody's part. Everyone's roles. Wow.
I know. Yeah. Why
that
not?
Makes sense. Yeah.
You're going to live in that world. You better know it. You know, you learn more about what other characters say about you.
Yes.
Whatever. That's a very important thing.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I used to, what you're reading from reminds me when I first started directing, I had one page on a word processor that I would keep all my thoughts and ideas and I'd print it out and put it in my script at the very front. Right. When I was directing, it was like just shorthand. It was thoughts. Right. It was filled with things like do it wrong. Let's try it wrong one time. Or, you know, it was just short ideas that I'd picked up about directing that I could share with actors when we got into a moment where the scene wasn't working or I could tell they weren't feeling satisfied. It was just things to remind myself to like suggest or say.
To think outside the box. Yeah. I mean, I would have a monologue, a very sad monologue, and I'd say, I'm going to do it like a stand-up, you know?
Right.
And do the whole
monologue. Try it wrong.
Do it wrong. Yeah.
Do it wrong. And I think that's a great idea. It's just care enough not to care, you know, so much, you know.
I love that you have that collection. That's handy. So cool. Yeah. It's great for people who are looking to be creative in whatever field to keep a bit of a journal of things that inspire you and because it's easy to forget when you're stuck in the process of trying to, prepare for a role or a play or a shoot. Mm-hmm. It's easy to forget the things that really registered for you at some point in your career.
Meryl Streep. I think the most liberating thing I did early on was to free myself from any concern with my looks as they pertain to my work. That's a very smart thing.
Very smart. Yeah.
Well, you two have inspired me to start making lists on my own. I think that's a great
journal.
Idea.
Even a little if journal. It's one page, if it's a whole journal of a whole little, you know,
I agree.
Private kind of collection of inspiration.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This is George M. Cohen, which he said to Spencer Tracy, whatever you do, kid, always serve it with a little dressing.
Yeah, nice.
These people said just amazing things.
Well, Ethan, thank you so much for sharing your process, your creative process, these amazing stories.
All right, everyone. We were so lucky to have Ethan Phillips joining us once again. And thank you again, Ethan. And for those of you who are Patreon patrons, please stay tuned for your bonus material. Everyone else, we'll see you next week with another episode. But once again, thank you, Ethan. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, sir.